supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is from the family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and on today's show, we're going to take an in-depth look at the issue. We're going to look at incidents, effect on families, resources for women, and treatment for abusers. My guests are Kathleen Ferraro and Richard Gellis. Kathleen Ferraro joins me by telephone from Arizona, where she's a professor of sociology at Northern Arizona University. She is a survivor, an activist, an author. Her book is called Neither Angels Nor Demons, Women, Crime, and Victimization. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan.
I'm also joined here in the studio by Dr. Richard Gellis. He's chair of the Child Welfare and Family Violence at the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. He's authored many, many books, including The Violent Home and The Book of David, How Preserving Families Can Cost Children's Lives. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Richard, you've written that domestic violence affects somewhere between 3% and 20% of families. That's a pretty wide range.
Well, it depends on your definition of violence. I think when we're talking about battering and severe physical abuse, that's where the 3% figure comes in. But there are other forms of violence that don't escalate into the kind of classic burning bed battering that the public resonates to, and that's shoving, pushing, grabbing, hitting that might not even raise notice among neighbors because they might not hear of it, and that's where the 20% figure comes from.
So I can hear many people listening to the show wondering, what about verbal abuse? Is that part of the 20%?
You know, I once was testifying in a trial. The answer to the short answer to that is no. It's not, because it's bigger. And I was testifying in a divorce trial, and the cross-examination, they asked me to define emotional abuse, and I said that it was a verbal act designed to tear down the self-esteem of your partner. You could be yelling, you could be screaming, you could be destroying property, you could be belittling. And halfway through the definition, the judge interrupted and said, well, that sounds like something I could do. And I said, and your point would be? Because when you really define emotional abuse the way we would have to define it to do research, the numbers are staggeringly high. 60, 70, 80% of couples will use some form of emotional abuse on one another. It's not illegal. You're not going to get arrested for it, but it does its share of harm.
Well, speaking of doing its share of harm, Kathleen, you have said that we're throwing out these statistics, but you said only 25% of women report abuse to police. And at one level, it makes sense. At another, how do we know that number? How do you know that it's 25%?
Well, there's a couple of sources for that statistic. We have the National Violence Against Women Survey that surveyed 8,000 women and 8,000 men about their experiences with violent victimization, partner as well as stranger, and they asked people if they contacted the police and why or why not. The National Institute of Justice has also sponsored research specifically on domestic violence and asked people if they had or had not called the police regarding their victimization, and also asked them their reasons for not contacting the police. And the biggest reason that women give for not contacting the police is the belief that they can't do anything about it.
I wonder, Richard?
Well, you know, the figure could be a little higher. Kathleen's right. Yeah. I mean, both of those studies, however, were prefaced by asking people to think of this violence as a crime. And so it's 25% of the women who think that they've been victims of criminal violence. The proportion of women who are pushed and shoved and grabbed, who don't even think of it as a crime, who will then turn around and call the police, is minuscule.
Right.
Let's try to understand who's at more risk. I'll start with you, Richard. Does it vary depending on income, age, race? What are the factors?
You know, there's two ways to answer the question. One, the common way, which is it can reach into any household. The sociological way of answering it is certain households have greater risks. So when the income is below the poverty line, the risk is much higher. When there is unemployment in the family, the risk is much higher. In neighborhoods where there are high rates of violent crime, the risks are much higher. It is a youthful phenomenon. The risks are much higher among couples 19 to 30. The risk then goes down to very small rates among 50 and 60-year-olds, but the 50 and 60-year-olds who are still hitting one another, that's at the more severe end, and they're fairly dangerous. Families that have children born out of wedlock have higher rates. Families with sexual difficulties, higher rates. I think we'll get to it later in the show, but it's worth pointing out that couples on the verge of separation or who have recently separated have higher rates.
One thing all of these have in common is stress. All of these families are under some form of stress. Am I oversimplifying?
Yeah, because we're all under stress. I think here what we're talking about is families that are under significant stressors and have an absence of resources, either economic resources or social resources or even community resources. There are some neighborhoods that have very high rates of domestic violence because they have such low rates of faith-based resources or social services or access to social services that there's no way of short-circuiting the conflict and the violence.
And I think Dr. Gellies has provided the original research that demonstrated that men that come from households where they were abused themselves and witnessed their own fathers being abusive to their mothers were at greater risk of perpetrating. And, of course, that's a very complex and controversial issue, is this intergenerational transmission notion of domestic violence. And maybe Dr. Gellies could talk about that more.
Why is it controversial? Doesn't sound
well. Just like Rich said, in terms of stress, there's certainly many people who come from households where they witness violence who are nonviolent, and there are more people in that category than people who actually perpetrate violence. And I think sometimes the popular press and even advocates tend to portray this intergenerational transmission as a complete explanation of why people become violent. And it's certainly not. And I think it's destructive in some senses because it takes the focus away from all these other factors that Dr. Gellies mentions, the lack of resources, the lack of support, and focuses on specific pathological families.
Richard, it does, however, increase the risk.
Yeah, it does. I think what Kathleen and I probably have spent most of our careers fighting against is the simple explanation. So the assumption that if you're abused as a child, you will automatically grow up to be an abusive partner, an abusive parent. And it's nowhere close to those numbers. You're talking intergenerational transmission probably affects 30% of individuals, and then you match that against the 3% or 2% who engage in violence who didn't have an experience with violence. So you can get there. It's just a heck of a lot easier to get there if you've had role models both as who are offenders and victims.
Neighbors tend not to report when they think there's a problem in someone else's home. Is this part of the old mentality that a man's home is his castle? Richard?
It's part of the man's home is his castle, and it's partly the other side of the awareness coin, that as we made people aware of the problem of domestic violence and we advocated for the high end, for the very severe violence, there's a certain amount of fear. If this guy is going to do this to his wife and I hear it through the walls, what's going to happen to me if I call the police? And personally, the only time I ever called the police is when I lived in Philadelphia, and I heard it through the walls, and the guy retaliated. I came out in the morning and found a certain amount of damage in the front of the house, and oddly enough, the wife never spoke to me again. She very much resented that we got involved in their marital difficulties that you heard very clearly through the wall at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And I would add, too, that this does vary by neighborhood characteristics. If you're in a neighborhood, a high-crime neighborhood, a drug-infested neighborhood, and you get identified as the person who's calling the police into the neighborhood, you may face repercussions not only from the specific abuser, but from other people in the neighborhood who don't appreciate you bringing the cops in.
So there's all sorts of risks. Nevertheless, what should a neighbor do?
Well, I think you have to call. Because the neighbor's not going to know whether it's a low-risk household or a high-risk household. And if you can hear it through the walls, I called, and I think you have to call. But I grew up in the 60s. The 60s, if you weren't part of the solution, then you were part of the problem. So I think it's important for communities to draw a line and say this behavior is not acceptable.
And I would say that, you know, calling the police is certainly the first step that you would want to take if you were hearing a dispute in progress. But beyond that, I would be trying to make contact with the woman when you knew it was safe, just to let her know that you're there. Is there anything I can do to help? Can I watch the kids for a little while you have a few minutes to yourself? And I think instead of just assuming that you call the police and then that takes care of it, is that as a neighborhood, you need to get to know your neighbors and show people that they're not isolated, they're not alone, because the isolation is one of the biggest factors that keeps women locked in violent relationships.
I want to take a step back and look a little bit at the bigger picture, nationally and culturally. If stress is a factor, and we talked about two economic issues, poverty and losing a job. I wonder if we look nationally, does domestic violence increase when the economy does worse? Richard?
It has. It just hasn't done so recently. Since 1994, according to the Justice Department figures, the self-reported victimization of domestic violence has gone down, although the homicide figures haven't budged very much. When I first got started in the 70s and 80s, the tracking was very much associated with unemployment rates and the economy. But our economy now, the way it affects people, it tends to affect people at the very bottom rung, who are already under so much stress that one more job loss doesn't make that much of a difference.
Right. We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to hear about how domestic violence affected one particular family. We're going to hear a pretty poignant interview. We're talking about domestic violence today. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. Richard Gellis and Kathleen Ferraro. Gellis is the director for the Center for Research on Youth and Social Policy, and he's co-director of the Field Center for Children's Policy Practice and Research at Penn, and he's written, among other things, the Book of David, How Preserving Families Can Cost Children's Lives. Farr is a professor of sociology at Northern Arizona University. She is an activist, author, and has written neither Angels Nor Demons, Women, Crime, and Victimization. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Think about your day, the time you spend in your car, on the train, with your family. Time, it's important to you. And WHYY 91FM won't waste your time. Explore the issues behind the headlines with programs like Fresh Air, Radio Times, and The Next Mayor. 91FM delivers news from around the world and around the block. And coming soon, StoryCorps will be in Philadelphia. Your time is important, and so is your support. To support 91FM, visit WHYY.org. The time is now.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about domestic violence today. And before we go back to our experts, let's hear one family story. Our associate producer, Elisa Walters, recently spoke with her mother, Grace, about the abuse they endured.
Tell me a little bit about what your relationship was like early on with my father.
Our relationship actually began when I was in high school. Looking back, I see that there were the flags that they talk about now, you know, the warning signs of abusive relationships. Him not wanting me to go places with my friends that I've had, you know, for years, my best friends. And as a result, I lost those friendships because more and more of my time was taken up with him, going places with my mother. He picked me up and took me to school every day. And he used to tell me that he didn't want me to wear makeup to school. He told me not to talk to other guys.
So tell me what your marriage was like early on, and then once you started having us, my older brother, my older sister, and my younger brother, and myself, obviously.
Early on in our marriage, we both worked. You know, it was everyday, day-to-day life. At one point, we worked opposite shifts, so we didn't see, every other week, we didn't see each other, and I liked that. I had a sense of freedom on those weeks because he wasn't around. Even though I didn't really do anything because I didn't have any friends anymore.
How was he with us?
If Heather and Matthew were misbehaving, for instance, if they had been put to bed and they were playing instead of sleeping and we had to keep after them, he would make them come out and he would either, sometimes he would make them pull their pants down and he'd spank them with a belt. And there were times, too, when he would put them outside on the porch, make them go outside. Of course, they didn't leave the porch. It was dark. He'd put them outside, close and lock the door, and turn the light off outside. And they would be out there crying and banging on the door that they wanted to come in. And at that point, I would stand up to him and say, "You can't do that," you know, and I would bring them in, which then caused a conflict with him and I. One thing about our fighting, it was either where he was making me sit there and listen to him, and he'd be like preaching to me about whatever it was we were fighting about, or there were times when I actually spoke up and argued back, where he would get so angry that he would either shove me or grab me, shake me maybe, or slap me. As time went on and toward the end and we did more fighting and arguing, there was one time in a car where all of you were in the car with us and he made me get out of the car and walk. There was also a time when he threatened to run the car in a tree because we were fighting and so he was going to make everybody pay.
That was on more than one occasion that he did those kind of things.
You remember those, because those were later on in the relationship, toward the end of the relationship.
When did you know that you wanted out?
I don't think there was one point that I suddenly said, "I want out." It was a process. As I was growing up and as time was going by and as I was seeing my children become people, little people, you know, with personalities and their own lives and their own ideas, that was probably what gave me the strength and made me realize, you know, now we're talking four other people here. It isn't just me anymore. And I have to protect those four little people who have their own ideas about things that he wanted to crush. The day that we left, he fell asleep on the couch, and I had called my friend and told her that I couldn't take it anymore. The police arrived at the door. When they knocked at the door, the dog barked, and he woke up. So you and Heather went out, and I was on my way out with Jonathan when he woke up, and he was pleading for me to not leave, you know, telling me, oh, please don't do this, you know, don't do this. But I told him I can't take this anymore, and I walked out. What do you remember about that day? How did you feel?
I remember I was 8 years old. I remember that leaving was a relief because I didn't feel safe with him. It was all of those moments, looking back on it, the driving really erratically when you guys were fighting and he was going to end it all for all of us. And in that state of mind, in that sense of terror, you don't know what he's going to do. And being so little, shouldn't have been exposed to it. And I remember thinking, he can't hurt us now. The police have us. And I remember when he hit you a couple of times, it was that day that Heather yelled at him. And he raised his voice and went to hit her. Don't hit my mom. Don't hit my mom. And I think that I felt very safe with you. Safer than I had in a long time.
That was our associate producer, Elisa Walters, talking with her mother, Grace, about their history of domestic violence. And that's what we're talking about today, domestic violence. My guests are Dr. Richard Gellis and Kathleen Ferraro. Gellis is chair of child welfare and family violence at the University of Pennsylvania. Ferraro is a professor of sociology at Northern Arizona University. She's written Neither Angels Nor Demons, Women, Crime, and Victimization at Northeastern Press. Lankener Hospital, by the way, is holding a domestic violence conference on October 19th. For more information, people can call 610-645-2000, and I'll announce that also at the end of the show. Well, that was a pretty poignant and powerful interview. Let me start with you, Kathleen. Elisa's mother said that there were warning signs right from the beginning. Can you tell us who's more at risk for entering an abusive relationship?
Well, I wish I had that answer in terms of entering the relationship. I think it could be just about anybody because I think some of the warning signs that is it Grace described?
Yes.
Things that we associate with falling in love. People want to spend all their time together. They kind of stop hanging out with their friends and spend all the time with a new romantic partner. So, and obviously, we don't think that's particularly healthy, but just about everybody does that at the beginning of relationships. So entering the relationship itself, I think just about anyone can do. But I think the characteristics that make someone more vulnerable to an abusive partner are coming from a background where they either were physically or sexually abused in their family, or, as I describe in my book, they were very lonely and didn't feel a lot of support from their nuclear family. And then they're looking for a partner who can fill that void in their lives. And also people who don't have a particularly strong hook into the larger community, either through their profession, their education, or just their network of friends, so that this new partner really becomes their whole world. And it sounds as if Grace was working, and she said that I liked that because that gave her some reality apart from this relationship and probably was influential in allowing her to get out of the relationship. The women that get most deeply entrapped are those who do not have anything outside of the relationship, and they they quickly come to see their abuser as all-powerful, and any attempt to leave him, and that's why they don't call the police, is doomed to failure.
Richard,
they don't have.
I would think that's more typical, because a woman who's at risk for getting into this relationship is someone who doesn't have a lot inside, feels kind of empty, lower self-esteem, so on and so forth. So she's not going to have a lot of resources outside.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is the point to introduce it. There are abusive men who sense that and take advantage of that lack of self-esteem and seek exactly that kind of relationship because they know they can go into it and control it. If children begin very early in the relationship, or pregnancy precedes the actual marriage, the more dependent this kind of a woman or woman in this situation becomes, the more vulnerable she becomes. The fewer other mirrors that are held up to her to show her how she looks to other people, the more vulnerable she becomes, because she can only see herself through the eyes of the abuser, and the abuser has a vested interest in diminishing her sense of self-efficacy.
Kathleen, there was an interesting statement we heard from Grace. It was as though at one point she woke up and realized that her children were like little humans, and something shifted. Her perception of the kids shifted. Is that unusual?
No, that's a common catalyst for doing something to get out of the relationship. Like Rich said, if the victim herself doesn't feel that she needs to make a change because she's worthwhile and she's a precious human being, she will often see her children in that light. And so when the abuse starts shifting to the children, that's when the light goes on and she recognizes, I've got to do something about this situation. Unfortunately, there are the most tragic cases where that signal doesn't go on, and the woman is unable to intervene on behalf of her children.
I want to comment now. When you just mentioned intervene on behalf of their children, your book, the title of your book, Richard, The Book of David, How Preserving Families Can Cost Children Their Lives. Tell us about that.
Well, that book actually is about the child welfare system and using family preservation as the one-size-fits-all for abused children, and the over-reliance on trying to keep families together. Now, that's exactly the opposite, I think, of the advocacy movement has been doing for domestic violence. But as Kathy was answering your question, I was thinking some women, like the case we just heard, leave for the sake of the children. But others stay for the sake of the children, either because they are worried what will happen to their children if they grow up, quote-unquote, without a father. But there are some abusers who it is really unsafe to try to get the children out of the home. That it's safer to try to keep a lid on things, even if you're unsuccessful, than to try to move with your dependent children. In child welfare, I'm one of the outliers who says, you know, some families aren't worth saving. And in domestic violence, some families simply aren't worth saving.
And you're an outlier?
In child welfare, that field really thinks every family is worth saving.
And what about in the domestic violence field?
Well, for a long time, the domestic violence field felt no family was worth saving, and then became frustrated that women would leave and then go back, and women would leave and then go back, and now had to readjust the expectations that, well, we need to empower women so they can make their own decisions. It's probably not appropriate for us to make them for them. So in the last 30 years, I think the view of domestic violence has been to recalibrate the salvageability of all relationships. But certainly domestic violence, when you compare it to child welfare, the response is much more on the controlling side. In other contexts, I'll say, you know, if you're abused by your husband, you get a police officer. If you're abused by your parents, you get a 25-year-old art history major.
What do you mean?
The first person to come to the household of a case of domestic violence will often be the police officer. But in child abuse, the first person to come to the household is a non-social worker caseworker. And they come with the notion of rehabilitation and therapy, not with the notion of controlling and limiting access of the abuser.
Right.
Tell us about the children, Kathleen. What's the impact on them of witnessing?
Well, the impact of witnessing is just like Elisa said, is that it creates a tremendous stress in the child. Children often feel responsible for their parents' relationship, as we know. And when there's domestic violence, the child is constantly worrying, what's going to happen to my mom and what can I do to protect her? And I've heard children say, you know, I didn't want to go to school because I was worried about mommy. And so the child takes on these adult responsibilities. They tend to have problems at school, and it varies by the sex of the child, because little boys, as they start to enter puberty, of course they want to identify with their father, and the father is saying, you know, things would go great in this family if your mom would just straighten up. Your mom's the one causing all the problems, and oftentimes the little boys will internalize that message and start being emotionally and sometimes even physically abusive to the mom as well.
Well, I've also treated men who were those little boys, and these men grew up and still feel helpless and impotent, as though they were responsible for standing up to their fathers and protecting their mothers, and they just felt that they weren't doing a good enough job and have lived their whole lives feeling inadequate and helpless and impotent. It gets played out in their marriages.
Well, and yeah, that's true. And then the sad and ironic thing is sometimes these same boys, when they do strike out at their fathers in trying to protect their mothers, they're the ones that get taken off to juvenile hall for assaulting their dad when, you know, the abuse has been going on in the family and they've, like you said, been feeling helpless. And then when they do strike out, all too often, they're the ones who are blamed for acting out.
What is battered woman syndrome?
Battered woman syndrome was a term that Lenore Walker developed in the late 70s, and she used it to try to help people understand how women get entrapped in relationships. And she relied on some psychological studies about learned helplessness to help people understand why a woman wouldn't just leave when there's abuse going on. And it was really helpful, I think, in shifting public consciousness about how women really do become entrapped in these relationships. But since that time, we've really moved away from the battered woman syndrome language, because it kind of gives the image of one-size-fits-all psychological malady that develops in women who are battered, and that's just not accurate. Women display a broad range of reactions to domestic violence depending on their current situation, their past history, and it's certainly not only a psychological response, and there's no psychological malady or disorder known as battered woman syndrome.
Tell us about your book and the gray areas between being a victim and a perpetrator.
Well, I think with the children that we were talking about is a really good example, because the women that I worked with that were charged with homicide in the death of their children, and the actual death was caused by their partners, but they were the women who were unable to break away from the abuser to protect their child, and so they're held legally responsible for the death of that child. And so I've seen women that were just horribly victimized by their partner who wound up killing their child, but had also had a lifetime of abuse from the time they were infants. Most of the women had been abandoned as infants by their birth mothers, abused by multiple caretakers, and then pregnant at age 14, 15, 16 with their first child, and then got entrapped in these awful violent relationships, and sometimes using alcohol and drugs as a way of numbing themselves to the pain. And then they become the offender when their abusive partner harms or kills, sexually abuses, physically abuses, or kills their child. And like Richard was saying, in most of these cases, child welfare system had intervened prior to the child's death. and reunited the family under this family reunification philosophy.
What needs to be done?
Well, we've done a lot with the criminal justice system, and I think now when the police are called to a domestic violence incident, there will be an arrest. It may be of the victim, it may be of the offender, it may be of both of them, but there will be an arrest if there's somebody there to arrest. What we haven't done as good a job of is providing the infrastructure for families that respond to the high level of explosiveness and intensity in some families. For example, we're still the only industrialized nation without a national child care policy. People are on their own. We know that when children are in quality child care facilities, that the possibility of detecting these kinds of abuses is increased, and there's more possibility for those families to have a positive intervention. When you just drop off your kid at the neighbor's when you go to work, or even leave the child home alone because you have no caretaker, there isn't that possibility of intervention. It also entraps people financially to not have those kinds of supports. So there's a in terms of housing, transportation, just community building, that part of the domestic violence picture we have not done a good job of at all, I think, in responding.
Richard?
I'm just going to add, I mean, I think I went absolutely berserk last week when the president vetoed SCHIP, because just as Kathy says that daycare provides good sentinels for children and families, when you now are taking poor families and saying, we're not going to provide you health care, you have to make choices between whether you're going to bring a child with an earache to a doctor or feed the family. This is not a society that's going to be able to align its resources to eventually be able to help in the area of child abuse and domestic violence. That was a simple bill, and I hadn't heard veto language like that since Nixon vetoed the Comprehensive Child Development Package in 1974 and said that it would Sovietize the American family. One of the greatest policy mistakes that this administration made, it made last week when it decided not to spread health care out. Now, you wouldn't ordinarily think of it in Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but it's absolutely critical that families are able to get access health care for their children, and critical that the health care system becomes a portal and a sentinel both for, remember, child abuse and domestic violence have an overlap of about 60 to 80%. Mm-hmm. So if you bring a child to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, they will and should be able to also identify domestic violence and align resources for the woman. I know what happens in New York City. We're just missing that opportunity.
So you're not just accessing health care, you're accessing an infrastructure with
it's a,
your
it's
children.
It's a portal. And it's a portal with sentinels, and those sentinels can be controlling if it need be, or can be compassionate if it need be.
We've got to take a short break. I want to come back, and I want to talk about the men, the perpetrators, and what's behind that, and what treatments are available for both sides in domestic violence. My guests are Richard Gellis, who's chair of the Child Welfare and Family Violence at the University of Pennsylvania. He's written The Violent Home and The Book of David, How Preserving Families Can Cost Children's Lives. Kathleen Farrar is a professor of sociology at Northern Arizona University, and she's written Neither Angels Nor Demons, Women, Crime, and Victimization, and that's published by Northeastern Press. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents choreographer Paul Taylor's Company B, set to the Andrews Sisters hits at the Merriam Theater October 10th to 14th. Also in this program is George Balanchine's Concerto Barocco and Matthew Neenan's As It's Going. Pennsylvania Ballet performs Company B at the Merriam. For tickets, 215-336-2000 or www.paballet.org.
Between Morning Edition
and All Things Considered,
we bring you Day to Day.
News, interviews.
If they get to me and they kill me, I can always leave something behind.
and features you won't hear anywhere else.
It's Good Radio in the middle of the day.
Day to Day from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about domestic violence today on Voices in the Family. My guest experts are Dr. Richard Gellis from the University of Pennsylvania and Kathleen Ferraro from Northern Arizona University. But what about the abusers? Why do they become abusers? And what kind of treatments are available for them? Dr. Stephen Stosny is a psychotherapist who developed a program that teaches abusive men compassion, and he founded a website called Compassion Power. He spoke early with our producer, Mike and Scott.
Dr. Stosny, how did you get interested in working with abusive men?
Well, I first got interested in about the age of 3 because I grew up in a violent home. And saw firsthand there it was child abuse and domestic violence. But what always struck me as I was growing up, that even though there was some pretty serious child abuse, what was far more engaging in my imagination was the abuse between my parents. And when I got to where I could research this, I found I wasn't that unusual, that children are more affected by seeing their parents fighting than by being victims themselves. And the way I started on a compassionate approach was really from my mother. I talked with her as a victim of domestic violence and was telling her what pretty much the predominant view then, that men try to dominate women and exercise power and control over them. But she said, no, that's not really it, that these men aren't angrier than anyone else. And they're not really that much more controlling. What they are is not compassionate. They don't have enough compassion to be able to see that when you hurt someone you love, you're really hurting yourself.
In your research and in your work with men who are abusive, what have you learned about the reasons why men become abusive?
They become abusive because they can't have a tolerable sense of self. They don't really feel adequate and lovable in themselves. They feel powerless pretty much. They try to exert power over other people. And if you just focus on the behavior, it's very difficult to change them. If you focus on the motivation, in other words, in the history of humankind, has anyone ever felt more lovable by hurting someone they love? The problem is if your wife does something that makes you feel unlovable, what you have to do is something that will make you feel more lovable, not less, and that usually means being compassionate to her.
What does your program look like?
Well, it's pretty intensive. We have a foundation of it that is 24 hours straight. You know, we try to do it in a boot camp kind of format, where and it's really possible to break through defenses that way. You are able to get them to see that their motivation to hurt somebody they love is because they feel hurt. But doing that will make it much worse. They don't like themselves when they're abusive.
So after this first initial boot camp, how does the work progress from there?
Well, then it's a 14-week follow-up where they come once a week for 2 hours.
And how do these men come to you? Are they referred by somebody, or do they come because they want to change?
Most of them are court-ordered. In this population, you rarely get a real volunteer. In other words, they recognize they have their own problem, and they want help for it. Usually, it's the court ordering them or their partners ordering them, because anger is an attribution of blame. You know, when you're feeling bad, it's somebody else's fault. So it's unusual that you'll get someone who wants help for their anger because they see it as everybody else's fault.
What are some of the key issues that these men learn how to recognize as they go through your program?
Well, what they recognize is that it's usually a long chain of resentment that they have. In other words, they have expectations of how they should be treated and what their wives should do. And those are what really produces the anger and rage if their partners don't do it. But what we teach them is, how realistic is it for me to have that expectation? And is it really what I want? Do I really want a wife that is going to do everything I say or one that's going to care about me. You see, what abusers do is they make a tragic substitution of power for value. They didn't fall in love to feel powerful. They fell in love to feel valued and to be valued and to value their partner. The exertion of power and control in a relationship will sometimes get you compliance. It'll never get you value. We get them to realize that what they really want is value, not power, and that anger and aggression isn't going to get you value. It's only going to get you power.
Stephen Stosny is a psychotherapist. He's founder of the website CompassionPower.com. He spoke with Mike and Scott. Richard, from a psychological viewpoint, what he says makes sense. What's your reaction?
Well, I work under a couple of mottos. I'm the dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at Penn, and we have a big MSW program. And I tell our MSW students the joke, how many social workers does it take to change a light bulb? Most of them don't know the answer at the beginning. And I say, well, it only takes one, but the light bulb has to sincerely want to be changed. Stephen's program, he's not going to be effective with a court-ordered program, save for the 1 in 5 men who go to court and probably want to engage in his program. Secondly, Kathleen has written about this, and I've written about it a little bit, there's a very wide range of offenders. Not so wide that they're all uniquely different, but wide enough that one size isn't going to fit all. So the compassionate approach is not going to work for a stalker. It's not going to work for a borderline personality disorder. It's not going to work for somebody who is chronically depressed and has a substance abuse problem. So it's built on a good psychological model, and it's going to be effective for a certain proportion of the population. That would be true of any intervention, that one size isn't going to fit all in this field, and we need a menu of interventions depending on the kind of offender and their amenability to change.
And back to the light bulb, will an offender who doesn't particularly want to change, do they have any chance of changing, even if they're ordered?
Not if they're ordered to. I mean, I know a lot of offenders who go through Duluth model groups. It's 52 weeks. These guys basically stand on their head in the back of the class and say, I can stand on my head for 52 weeks. It doesn't mean I'm going to change. I don't think you can stay in Stephen's program for 52 weeks, but you'll drop out. And probation doesn't track offenders so well that they even know who drops out.
So what are the treatments? Let me turn to you, Kathleen, and we'll talk about women and families. What are the treatments that are available, and what are the treatments that work?
Well, I couldn't agree with Rich more. It depends on the type of domestic violence and the type of offender that you're talking about. I think Stephen's program is just wonderful for a certain kind of offender. But for the more serious offenders, like Rich is talking about, the stalkers and the people with borderline personality, one of the things the domestic violence movement has been resistant to is psychological explanations of domestic violence perpetrators. Because the official line is, you know, it's men beat women because they can, because they're given this authorization by a male-focused culture. But, of course, the reality is the majority of men don't beat women, and so there's something about the men that do that we need to address. And I think that there's a type of offender who, and maybe these are the men that you work with, Dan, that do have psychological problems. And you can't treat them with a Duluth power and control model when they have a serious mental disorder and expect their behavior to go away. So there's certainly a category of men who do need mental health treatment. There's also a group of men who have serious chemical dependency issues that they're not going to be open to changing their orientation towards battering while they still have a serious chemical or alcohol dependency issue going on. And Rich has written about this, that alcohol and drugs don't cause people to batter. But when you have that chemical dependency going on, their consciousness certainly isn't in a place where they can learn how to be compassionate or to understand analytically the nature of their behavior. One of the problems with the batter intervention treatment programs is that a lot of women say, oh, yay, now everything's going to be okay. He's been ordered to treatment. And it gives them a false sense of hope. And I think when you're engaged in a relationship where there's serious domestic violence occurring, that there has to be a whole network of support for the victim. It can't just be that now he's in batter intervention and he's going to be okay.
That's what I want to hear. We've got limited time left, and I do want to hear about the network of support that the victim needs.
Well, one of the things she needs is legal advocacy, and the shelters work very well, getting orders of protection in place, helping her to get temporary custody of the children. Employers and the schools all need to be alerted about the danger that she may be facing. And some cities, like San Diego, is now developing a rapid response team. What we've seen in the past is sometimes the sheriff's office will know about the incarceration, the shelter will know where the woman's at and the kids are at, and then there may be a batterer's intervention program that knows about the guy, and the three are not communicating about the level of danger to the woman. And we do have coordinated community response teams where everybody's supposed to be communicating, but they're... Women are falling through the cracks in these. So we need to increase the level of communication between all the players that have engagement with this family so that there's a safety plan in place, and whenever the man is free from jail, free from batterer's intervention, that the woman knows where he's at and law enforcement knows where he's at, so that there's no possible slippage where he just shows up and begins his abuse or his lethal actions again.
You know, one thing I'm hearing from both of you repeatedly throughout the show is that before anything happens, we have to establish safety. The violence has to stop. We have to do whatever we can to establish safety. And all of that has to precede psychotherapy, insight, reflection, history, all that stuff, that nothing starts until safety is established. And I think if there's one message that comes out of it, it's that safety has to happen, and it's got to be present in all families pretty consistently. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
My guests have been Richard Gellis and Kathleen Ferraro. Gellis is the Joanne Raymond Welsh Chair of the Child Welfare and Family Violence Department. He's Dean of Social Policy and Practice at Penn. Ferraro is Professor of Sociology at Northern Arizona University, and she is a survivor and an activist. Join me on Thursday. I'm speaking at Morristown Friends School about child rearing. You can get more information on my website, drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Shane Ewing's our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.